Welcome to Citizens Climate Radio. In this show, we highlight people's stories. We celebrate your successes, and together we share strategies for talking about climate change. I'm your host, Peter Santoscano. Welcome to episode 35 of Citizens Climate Radio, a project of Citizens Climate Education. This episode is airing on Saturday, April 27th, 2019. On today's show, we hear your answers to the puzzler question. Your Uncle Ralph is skeptical about climate change. He asks you, if global warming is happening, how come we just had such a cold winter in America? Listeners provide smart and thoughtful answers. In the Art House, you will meet Peter Buckland. As a member of his municipal council, Peter helped usher in changes to how his township gets its energy. His concern about climate change and the planet was hammered into him from an unlikely source: heavy metal music. He reveals how for decades, heavy metal bands have been raising the alarm about climate change. But first, we must visit paradise. I know, in episode 33, we went to an island in the Philippines. On today's show, we go to the Hawaiian island of Oahu. Meet Nicole Chatterson. Originally from Southern California, Nicole has embraced the outdoors of Hawaii. On a gorgeous day, we met in a park in Honolulu to chat. In the background, you'll hear birds and a neighborhood baseball game going on. With so many options of things to do, I asked Nicole, how does she spend a day off in paradise?
Usually in the mountains or at the ocean. Today I was torn, should I surf or should I go play in these beautiful, clear, crisp mountains today?
How different from Palmdale, California, where she grew up?
I grew up in inland Southern California in the high desert, so no water, lots of tumbleweeds, kind of a suburban spill-off of LA.
She tells me Palmdale is the methamphetamine production capital of Southern California. It also was a place where she saw a lot of trash.
I grew up in an area that was about a mile away from the dump. And so I watched this mountain basically being erected that was full of all of our crap. Then you had to pay to dump items of a certain size, you know, if your couch, your old mattress. Because we live so close to the dump, people would come and just dump stuff basically right across the street from our house because they couldn't afford to put it in the dump. When I went out to explore, and there was like a water heater and some buckets of paint and then this like, you know, beautiful bunny hopping by.
So what brought Nicole to the Hawaiian Islands? Ironically, the pursuit of more trash.
I was working with a group that was looking at plastic in the ocean. I was like the office aide doing all the random tasks, and everybody else was getting to go out and sail. And so I was trying to wiggle my way into that work. You know, learned how to sail and put my time in, and I was invited on a trip that stopped over on Oahu here. So that was my first time to Hawaii. Fell in love with this place and was also kind of strangely attracted to this problem of the world's trash washing up in this really special remote place.
She explained how they do this sort of research in the Pacific Ocean.
We had these things called trawls, and it's a device that floats on top of the water, and then there's a filter, and so you kind of skim the surface of the water and it filters out the plastic. So we were collecting samples of water with this filter to see how much plastic was in it.
Nicole decided to stay in Hawaii.
Just finished my master's degree at the University of Hawaii doing cultural anthropology, and I was on an environmental track looking at culture and the environment. Right now I work with the University of Hawaii System Office of Sustainability, and my job there is I'm the living lab coordinator, so I'm helping to build out collaborative systems with students and faculty and staff in the community to use the university as a testing space for different sustainability programs or processes.
Nicole has become an expert in plastic wastes in the ocean.
Always when we put the nets in, there would be these little microplastics. Actually, I think the technical term now is mesoplastics, because you can see them, so they're not microscopic. plastic confetti, which sometimes you could see from the boat and sometimes you couldn't see until you pulled up this trawl. And other times there were just large pieces of junk floating around. Like there was a piece of a refrigerator we saw, lots of baskets and ropes and nets and light bulbs. Yeah, all kinds of stuff.
For years, I have been hearing about a massive island of trash floating in the ocean, the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. It floats and grows ever larger in the water somewhere between Hawaii and California. It is estimated to be larger than the state of Texas.
There are definitely collection zones, but it's more like a soup or a curry. Water with chunks of things floating around, so the trash hasn't kind of coagulated onto a mass that you can sort of put a flag on and claim. It's also distributed throughout the water column, so it's not just floating on the surface. We have trawls that can also skim maybe 30 feet below. Those trawls will pull up plastic, and they're also now finding plastic water bottles on the seafloor.
Lately, I've also been hearing a lot about banning types of plastics, particularly single-use plastics. The plastic straw is currently the naughty poster child of the plastic ban. As a climate advocate, I confess I've been concerned about plastics, but not fully aware of how much plastic production and waste contribute to greenhouse gas pollution. What are the connections between climate change and plastics?
So many connections. The simplest place to start is thinking about what plastic is made out of. So plastic is fossil fuel. And by 2050, the UN estimates that 20% of our fossil fuel budget is going to be used just for plastic. Then we also get into what happens when that plastic starts to break down. So whether it's slowly photodegrading in the sun on a beach somewhere in the ocean, or if it's being incinerated for energy, which is a common way to get rid of trash now, you're releasing that carbon that's been stored. And so it's a similar process of taking this fossil fuel and then releasing the carbon into the atmosphere. One ton of trash we throw away, there have been 70 to 90 times that amount of waste created in the extraction, production, transportation, and use processes of these items turn trash. So if you take a water bottle, you can sort of imagine 70 water bottles invisibly attached to this that represent the waste and pollution outputs, the energy use, the land use.
Nicole points out individual changes can make a difference. By using a reusable water bottle, you can make a significant impact in the carbon footprint of your water consumption.
If you're thinking of your kind of standard virgin plastic water bottle, if you were to replace that with a 30% recycled content water bottle, your carbon footprint drops by about 20 or 30%. And then if you're bringing your own reusable water bottle, your carbon footprint drops by about 90%.
Nicole stresses, though, individual changes are a drop in the bucket. We need larger system changes.
Changes in packaging design. We make a lot of design choices based on the need to advertise goods. And so you find things extravagantly packaged in ways that don't make a lot of sense for some of our social and environmental needs. So that's one system that has a lot of potential for change. And there are already tons of solutions with alternate materials to plastic or just slimming down the packaging. I think another system that needs to change is how we manage our trash. Most of what we do is called reactive waste management or downstream waste management. It's the moment where you decide to intervene after the trash has been created. So that could be recycling, it could be burning the trash, it could be burying the trash. If we were to move towards proactive or upstream waste management and think about our job as municipalities, as humans, to work in that sphere, I think that thought shift would lead to a lot of important systems change.
I first heard about waste-to-energy production in Sweden. The city of Malmö began incinerating trash to help heat the very cold city. My friends there told me the plant had multiple filters in place to stop any pollution. Although it is a very expensive process, I wondered if this was one of the big solutions we needed to embrace.
waste to energy has become, for some people, this perfect silver bullet. Landfills suck. Everybody knows that. They leach. No one wants them around their neighborhoods and communities. So how cool is it that we can just burn all this trash, have less mass to put in a landfill because the ash at the end still needs to go in a landfill, and then we get to make a little bit of energy. The tricky thing about this system is in order for it to work, there needs to be a guaranteed amount of trash. And so here, for example, we've signed a contract with Covanta that runs this waste-to-energy plant that we will produce 800,000 tons of trash a year. And if we don't, we pay a fee that covers some of the lost revenue. Taxpayers cover that cost of lost revenue for Covanta. What this does is two things. It's created this idea that it doesn't really matter what we produce because we can throw it away and it does something good. It creates clean energy, local energy. And when you look at the smokestack emissions, we're finding that H-Power is actually producing three times more GHG emissions per megawatt of energy produced than our largest oil burning plant. And that's consistent with data that's coming out globally around how incineration works.
The Covanta contract doesn't end until 2035. According to their website, Covanta boasts that through their global operations, they reduce greenhouse gases by 20 million tons annually. By putting the incinerators in local communities, they say they save on the fuel emissions that come from the long-haul transportation of trash. They reduce CO2 emissions in one part of the cycle, and then they release them in another. I reached out to Covanta to hear what they had to say in response, but they did not respond to any of the requests I sent them. Hawaii is very far from most of us. I live in rural central Pennsylvania, far from the beach. While I have heard a lot about plastics in the Pacific Ocean, I was unaware of plastics in my own community. I turned to Carol Perenzin, the Middle Susquehanna Riverkeeper. From Carol, I learned that the Susquehanna is the longest commercially non-navigable river in the U.S. Geologically, the Susquehanna is considered the oldest major river system in the world. It is also a major source of pollution. 50% of the fresh water entering the Chesapeake Bay comes from this river. It also contributes about 43% of its pollution. But what about plastic pollution? Carol put me in touch with a student at nearby Bucknell University, someone who recently spent a lot of time taking samples of river water in search of plastic. Meet Dominic Chicatano. Dominic grew up in Berwick, Pennsylvania, a town known for really good Italian food. I asked Dominic, what is the best pizza in Berwick?
I'm obligated to say my dad's pizzeria because that's what my parents do, Chicatano's.
His parents have run this restaurant since before Dominic was even born. The region where we live is sometimes called the Rust Belt. In spite of the magnificent natural beauty around us, the towns can look faded and crumbling.
I grew up in a small, little neighborhood in Berwick. It was really close to a park, a baseball field. If you drive about 3 minutes, you'll see cornfields. Lots of cornfields, yeah. My hometown of Berwick, I think, is like a lot of other places in central PA in that agriculture is important, and that's definitely visible when you're driving through. But I think Berwick is also really a post-manufacturing town a little bit. Kind of has that, dare I say, rundown feel to it because it used to be a manufacturing town for tanks during the Second World War. But I still always found some nature growing up.
Dominic has spent a lot of time in the Susquehanna River over the past year.
I saw suspended sediments sampling being done, so people would kind of wade out into the rivers, and this is what I did with a pretty big cone-shaped net and really high boots to try to see how much microplastic was passing through the water at any given moment. I took my samples, I dried them out, put them through multiple sieves of different sizes, and manually sorted all of them. So that was pretty brutal, picking through all this sediment to see what was plastic and what wasn't.
Like Nicole, in the Pacific Ocean, Dominic scooped up samples of water, then analyzed what he found.
I found what I believe to be plastics at every single site that I visited.
And like Nicole, Dominic found tiny man-made particles in the water, including styrofoam.
It was one of the first pieces I saw. I remember I was under the microscope and it was like white and like flaky and had like a foamy texture. I was 2 minutes into picking through my samples and I was like, this is already styrofoam. Took a picture and I shared it with Carol, the river keeper, and she was understandably upset as well. So that was a little bit of like a moment for me. I didn't take long for me to see a piece of styrofoam in what's supposed to be clean river water. I saw a good deal of film plastics in my samples. So like, you can think about things like a plastic bag. You can also think about things that you peel off packaging or bags, just things that are a little bit waxy and thinner and kind of flat. Single-use plastic bags are notorious for catching wind and floating out of like landfills. They're buoyant, so they float in water. They travel really, really easily for something that is so environmentally disastrous. Films are one kind that I've noticed. I also saw some microbeads, some teal, bright blue microbeads, you know, things that you would expect to come out of a face cleanser. I saw a lot of fibers. So these things can be shed from our clothes when we put them in the wash. Like a polyester fabric can shed, I forget even the exact figure, but thousands of microplastic fibers in one wash. When you think about that, that's like an input that is so invisible right now.
The purpose of Dominic's study is to educate people who live near the river.
I've had some really great conversations with people who didn't know anything about microplastics coming in and were now like are actually concerned about the issue after talking to me. So part of doing research for me is just being able to make that information accessible to others.
Like Nicole, Dominic believes we need to pursue policy changes that will get us off of single-use plastic. But he also feels he needs to make changes where he can, including the family pizza business.
It's funny, I had them make the switch away from styrofoam, but it was hard for them because they're always thinking numbers, you know, and as a small business owner, and rightfully so, I think everybody is to a degree. So how are we going to make these alternative products more accessible to people in the future? Because ultimately, I don't think living a low plastic lifestyle shouldn't just be a matter of having economic privilege over other people. So it's going to be about these things going mainstream. But like anything else, I think that's going to take a lot of time.
Dominic Chicatano and Nicole Chatterson are thinking about big changes that need to be done. By hearing them both, you might get the idea they despise all plastics and want to ban them outright. I asked Nicole, are you anti-plastic?
Well, no. My surfboard's made of plastic. The fins on my surfboard are definitely plastic. Pretty sure my phone cover is plastic. I think that there's a difference between harnessing and using this material for durable goods and then using this permanent material for single-use items. And it feels not only not ethical to me, but not resource efficient. It doesn't make a lot of sense. It takes a lot of energy to make plastic, and then to momentarily use it is where I draw the line. And I try and shift my own behavior, but also try and shift systems so that we have other options.
Plastic pollution is not just about the seas and the fish and the other organisms in our waterways. For Nicole, it's her concern for people that motivated her to research trash and to look for solutions to plastic pollution.
Something that I didn't even think about at first when I got involved in this issue, I was moved by environmental justice and social justice components of plastic production. It's dirty to produce, of plastic recycling. We have this idea that, when we send our bottle overseas, it's going to become something else, and isn't that beautiful and wonderful? And the reality is probably some kid and his or her family are sitting there melting down the plastic in their home, pulling it out of these, you know, mixed piles of trash that were formerly sent to China, and China's now rejecting. So these were the things that moved me. And now I'm also moved by this connection with, you know, over-carbonizing our atmosphere.
In our show notes, you will find links to our guest. I also provide a dig deeper section where you can learn about plastic pollution, waste energy plants, the Susquehanna River, and much more. Just visit citizensclimatelobby.org/blog. Click on the Citizens Climate Radio link on the menu to the right. Look for episode 35. That link again, citizensclimatelobby.org/blog. Now, It is time for the Art House. Music can speak to our deepest selves. It can comfort us. It entertains. It can move us to action. We each find the music that speaks to us. In the Art House today, I introduce you to Peter Buckland. He's a leader in campus sustainability at Penn State University. He's a locally elected politician who's been successful in changing energy policy in his municipality. And he's a poet. In conversation, Peter revealed to me the role music has played in educating him about ecology and climate change. But it was not crunchy granola folk music that engaged him. It was heavy metal music. Now, I confess, I have never been a fan of heavy metal with all that demonic artwork and over-the-top visuals and sound. Still, whenever I hear that something someone loves got them thinking about climate change, I get curious. What Peter shared surprised and delighted me. But first, I needed to learn the basics about heavy metal and the variety of subsets to the genre.
There's plenty of it that's really stupid, but there's a really cool, very powerful, critical strain of metal, and it pops up mostly in two genres: thrash metal and grindcore. And they are both really politically oriented. They take on the status quo in all kinds of ways.
Peter explained that heavy metal is about power. It could be the power of riding a motorcycle or the power of sex and sexuality. This power gets communicated in powerful, loud, and very fast music. Some heavy metal bands and songs also explore power sources that cause great harm.
Metal is fundamentally about power. And what thrash metal and grindcore do is they focus on that part of power that is dangerous. It could be uncontrollable, or it's uncontrolled, or you don't know where it's coming from. So you get insanity, murder, war, corruption of the government, blacklisting, and environmental degradation. What I've found, I mean, I've been listening to this stuff for like 30 years almost. There are bands from Black Sabbath on who are taking a very critical look at what people do to each other and do to the planet.
I admit, I never intentionally listened to an entire heavy metal song in my life. But if there's music that speaks about climate change, I want to know about it.
So we could pull out a Testament record, get the New Order, and put on the song Greenhouse Effect. The song is about an environmental holocaust caused by human beings dumping too many greenhouse gases into the air. And it's not stupid. And it was written around the time that Jim Hansen spoke to Congress and was on the cover of the New York Times.
Listening to this music with headphones is not enough, though. Peter says the real metal experience happens with thousands of others during a live concert.
You go to a show, you're surrounded by all these people, and so that you go to any show, you're surrounded by all these people. You are overwhelmed by the incredible volume and speed of what's happening. And even if it's not really fast, the bodily impact, I mean, you feel the whole thing in your body because it's just so loud. Then you have whatever its message is, you know, it's a forbidden message. That's thrilling, but you're doing it with all these other people, right? And so you get this, oh, we really know what's going on feeling. You confront these things that are sometimes terrifying.
And they don't even care. They steal the planet's fate. Plastic puppets wait. Wasting precious land. It's time to take a stand. What about you? What sort of music do you listen to that helps you with your own climate work? If you have an idea for the Art House, feel free to contact me, radio@citizensclimate.org. That's radio@citizensclimate.org. Now, it is time for our monthly puzzler question. I'll share the puzzler question and some of the answers I've received. So, here's the question. You were at a family dinner when you mentioned your excitement about more and more people becoming concerned about climate change. Your uncle Ralph interrupted. Global warming? Seriously? What about all this record cold weather we've had? It doesn't seem like it's warming at all. So, what did you say? Trevor Stone sent his answer in an email. Voiceover actor Richard Bowen reads it for us.
You know how when you get the flu, your body gets a fever and your body gets the chills? The same thing happens with climate change. Global warming means the planet is running a fever, but it also gets the chills. And like breaking out in a sweat, the warmer atmosphere changes the patterns of airflow, pulling cold air down from Canada in the winter and pushing warm air up toward Greenland in the summer.
Brian Etzling in Portland, Oregon, left the following message.
Hey, Uncle Ralph. Interesting point you make. Fellow Missourian Mark Twain once said, quote, "Climate is what you expect. Weather is what you get," unquote. I spent many years learning as much as I can about climate change, and I'm still amazed how much people confuse weather versus climate. Well, Uncle Ralph, according to the Weather Channel, weather is something we experience on a short-term or daily basis. Basically, is it sunny or rainy outside today? The climate is the overall average of weather conditions in a certain area over a 20 to 30 year period. Climate is the percentage of long underwear versus shorts in your closet. Weather is if you're going to decide to wear long underwear or shorts today.
Thank you to everyone who sent me your answers, and thank you, Brian, thank you, Trevor, and thank you, Richard, for reading the answer. So, are you ready for our new puzzler question? It is especially designed for people in groups like Citizens Climate Lobby and other groups that are lobbying Congress. Here goes. You attended one of the recent student walkout demonstrations. While there, you spoke to a parent, Claire. Claire's daughter was a protest organizer. You tell Claire about the work you do speaking to legislators about laws that will address fossil fuel pollution. Claire confesses, "I would never have the patience for that. I'm so angry, and I need to protest." She then asks, "So why do you do that kind of advocacy work instead of protesting and civil disobedience?" This puzzler question gets you to question yourself about what you do and why you do it. I'd love to hear from you. Send me your answers by May 15th, 2019, along with your name, contact info, and where you're from. You can email your answers to radio@citizensclimate.org or leave a voicemail of 3 minutes or less at the following number, 518-595-9414, plus one if you're calling from outside the USA. The email again is radio@citizensclimate.org and the number 518-595-9414. Well, we've come to the end of episode 35. Thank you so much for listening. And thanks also for all the people who have been rating and reviewing the show over at Apple Podcast. The show is written and produced by me, Peter Santoscano. Other technical support from Ricky Bradley and Brett Cease. Social media assistance from Ashley Hunt Montorano, Flannery Winchester, Allison Cabisco, and Steve Volk. Moral support from Madeline Pera. All the music we use on the show is licensed, unless otherwise specified. Special music from The Art House includes music from archive.org. Be sure to share Citizens Climate Radio with your friends. You can find us wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also listen at northernspiritradio.org. Join the discussion at our Facebook group page, facebook.com/group/citizensclimateradio. You can follow us on Twitter at @CitizensCRadio. That's Citizens, the letter C, Radio, @CitizensCRadio. Many thanks to Silicon Valley North Citizens Climate Lobby Group for all of the retweets. Thank you so much. visit citizensclimatelobby.org/blog to see info about our puzzler and to find links to our guests. Citizens Climate Radio is a project of Citizens Climate Education.